Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Friday, April 1st, 2016. It is 8:06 a.m. I am Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me at the table, Co-Chairman Kelly.
Good morning.
Vice Chairman Michicki.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good morning.
Senator Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
We have a full complement in Senate Finance today. Before the committee is SB 91, Omnibus Crime Law and Procedures and Correction. Is there anything else to come before the committee before we start down the road of SB 91? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to invite Senator Coghill and his staff, Jordan Schilling, to the microphones. If you could identify yourself. Senator Coghill, if you could pause for one moment. Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, what tab should we be on?
There's a presentation that we'll have in a folder that's out. We're getting opening comments right now. Senator Kelly, welcome to Senate Finance. I'm sorry, Senator Coghill, welcome to Senate Finance.
Much more handsome, so I'll take it. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Senator Coghill from Senate CB. And with me is Jordan Schilling, who really is the kind of the mechanic or the subject in the bill mechanic, or I wouldn't say expert, because this is one of those places where we have to enlist a lot of experts in order to help us through this. What I'd like to do is at least do a high overview on what I expect that you'll look at today. The other issues, when I look at this issue, I usually work on a sheet like this that talks about the categories as well as the bill sections. And so if you want to turn to the bill sections, I'll name them out loud so that you can go to that if you wish. But I was just going to run down some of the things that I think are yet to be talked about. I understand that Mr. Schilling went through your sectional with you yesterday, so I think that'll help kind of frame some of the things that I want to at least introduce to you this morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Coghill, tab 3 for the committee has the product that Senator Coghill is using as a guide to the sectional that's broken down by topics. Today's topics are the miscellaneous other sections that we haven't covered. Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is how it helps me look at both the categories, because when we were going through the commission process, they looked at pretrial sentencing and community supervision. But there were other things that had been introduced into this bill that didn't fit into those categories clearly or neatly, and they became the other category. For example, we wanted to look at this with oversight. So we put in sections 142 to 146 ways that the commission could do oversight. And I think it would be instructive if you turn to section 142 at this point, only because I think it's 142, page 88. Under the powers and duties of the commission, if you look on page 88, line 17 through 19, you'll see kind of what we set in order, and then I'll talk about some of the things we wanted to add. On page 88, line 17, it says, shall evaluate the effect of sentencing laws and criminal justice practices on the criminal justice system, to evaluate whether those sentencing laws, criminal practices, provide for protection of the public, community condemnation of the offender, the rights of the victims, and the rights of the accused and the person convicted. And all along the way, we've tried to continually balance those things all along the way. You'll see in the highlighted area, the emboldened area, underlined, the commission shall annually make recommendations. We're asking them to come back with a demonstration of recommendations to the governor legislature on how savings and reforms should be reintroduced for recidivism benefits. And the way it's done is on page 89, line 23, they will appoint a working group to do the recommendations. They will enter into data sharing agreements with the Judicial Council, the University of Alaska. In other words, we're using resources that are available now. We're not standing up anything. We're just drawing from that. And then on page 90, there's a whole new subsection of what the commission shall do. And these are ways of data mining that are going to help us review and then report both to the legislature, to the governor, and to the public on how this is actually working. And I think that kind of oversight is very, very important, because we have new concepts in this law that if we do not review them and then re-discuss them and have somebody's eyes on them that isn't just a two or three committee hearing, but a process, I think it's going to be important. So getting the data, keeping the principles of why we're doing it in place, the commission principles, and now this new subsection on necessary information that is going to help us make these decisions. So in this bill, you're going to see this oversight. That does come from recommendation 19 and 20. And so that oversight, I think, is very important. Some of the other things that were that are in this bill that fall outside of the recommendations but are things that have been worked on in the legislature for quite a few years now and are in this particular bill, and that is on driving license privileges. Many people have had their driver's licenses revoked, both because of court action and some because of administrative action. And so you're going to see that what we're saying is, under some conditions, we would allow people to regain their license, but they have to go through a process. They have to be able to do something like the 24/7 program or an interlock. But what we're trying to do is get people back into productive work, but it's under accountable conditions. And the limited driver's license is 81 and 82 and 88 are kind of the prop, operatives, and Mr. Schilling can go
page
through that.
Page 50 on is section 80 in the bill that starts speaking about driver's license for those following us at home. Page 50 in version S starts section 81 on driver's license.
And my point, Madam Chair, was just to give you a high overview. If you want to dig into these with Jordan Schilling, because I'm going to have to excuse myself here pretty soon, but I wanted to at least give some rationale for these being in the bill, and they have been thought through, and both DMV and the courts have been worked with on this. And the administrative license revocations are kind of interesting. If you are stopped for a DUI, the DMV can actually take away your driver's license. However, there's no provisions to get into a due process right now in law, and so under the provisions we have in here, if you are found to be innocent, and there are two conditions, maybe I can ask Mr. Schilling to help me with the two conditions are.
For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. That provision simply says that if your case is dismissed or you are acquitted, you shall receive your driver's license back.
So those are the two conditions, which are not presently in law. And sometimes you can even be acquitted and still have an administrative revocation, which the DMV can, in my view, stubbornly hold on to. So I think this is just getting it back into a due process circumstance. So that's the limited driver's license and the administrative revocation. Food stamps, I said in the introduction, were this was a recommendation that came from the commission, but it came earlier than the report. It came to us early on last year. If you're a convicted offender for a robbery or a violent crime and you serve your time and you get out of jail and you're on probation, you qualify for food stamps right now if you're at that level of qualification. If you're convicted of a drug crime, the answer is you can't. And that's a federal law. But the exception is that if a state wants to allow for food stamps, then you may. And so what we're doing is we're making that election. And I think we're one of only six states that does not include that election. And the reason I thought this was wise to put it in there, not only because of the commission recommendations, but it goes into post-incarceration planning. And that is, how do you get somebody back into a workforce and keep them from a life of crime. And this is just one of those tools that that the commission and myself feel that are important. The same thing, though, is true with public assistance. If you do go on public assistance and you've been convicted of a drug felony, and we talked about this at the introduction, that and this is new, this is not from the administration, the commission, I'm sorry, but from the State Affairs Committee, that if you fail a UI test or you fail a drug test, or that you would be, you would lose your right to that assistance. That it's a high penalty, but it's based on a public safety issue and an incentive for people to be in programs. That was the two main incentives. And it was juxtaposed against those who have to work in, say, a restaurant and have to do UAs or UIs because of their work, or have to drive a truck, or work in a public safety arena, or working for, say, a big box store as a security person. They all have to take UAs. So that was the put into that. The only thing that I would look for is how do we make that a how do we get a flex point in there somehow, and I just haven't figured that out. So that is an open question. The reentry program is at 90 days before somebody is returned back into society, they begin a reentry planning process. This is new. It's not happening now. There are some assessments that are happening, but this deals with everything from getting an ID to a reentry plan for what is your work skills, what is the workforce capable of, what are your skills, maybe even examining them for past work skills, things like that. Anyway, it's a reentry program planning. It's almost like what you do in school with an IEP. It's very similar. The community work is if somebody is too poor to pay a fine, this is in sections 59 and 60, I think 60 being the most operative. The community work is if you are too poor to pay a fine, that community work service is a way that you can play. They can actually have sentence you to a work service program. Right now, in law, you can work for $3 an hour in community work service. What we're doing is saying at least make that minimum wage. But we're also saying election to go back into jail is not the option. It's an open door that swings one way. You go out to work, you pay your fine, but you can't just sit out in jail. So it's something that is a tool that the court can have for community work service. And the limiting of pretrial credit to 120 days, that's 55 and 56, sections 55 and 56, was amended in the Judiciary Committee. The reason we put the 120 days in was, this was actually came from OVR, Office of Victims' Rights, for the most part. We had people sitting in pretrial for long periods of time, and before they were sentenced, they were able to stretch out the court date and actually get time served for the 120 days. What we're saying is we want speedy trials to be better, and the rolling of that can be a problem. One of the big problems is you can actually do it on electronic monitoring. And so if we're going to use tools like electronic monitoring, and get credit for some time served, we want to have a limitation on that so that we're not incentivizing people to hold a court date out. So that's kind of what that is. And in the Judiciary Committee, they put some of the more violent crimes out of that limit. On reflection, I think that's probably the wrong way to go about it. So I would want to go back to what OVR suggested to limiting to 120 days. And when it comes time, if you want, Mr. Schilling can speak to that. The suspended entry of judgment that you'll find on Section 61 is an attempt to change what's happened under the suspended of sentence, suspended imposition of sentence. Right now, if you plead guilty, you can go to a program and have the jail time and the sentence waylaid. This was an attempt to move that judgment closer to you, where you can actually do the time without having to plead guilty. That's not how it's ended up, though. It's so close to the suspended imposition sentence right now, I don't know the real value. We are trying to say it shouldn't go on court view under those conditions, but in the first committee referral, they came back up on court view. So I don't know, and maybe Mr. Schilling can speak to it a little more broadly, or maybe that's something a commission member can speak to. The victim's rights issue, though, I think is probably one of the places where some of the best work has been done as we've gone through the process. Right now, if you're a domestic violence and you are a victim, you have the right to have a conference before plea agreements. This bill opens it up to all those under felons that are being considered for plea bargaining. And it's one way to kind of shine a light on what's going on the plea agreement deals. And I think this is an honest-to-goodness victims' rights benefit that is coming our way. So this all felons instead of just DV felons at this point. So that's kind of the high-level view, Madam Chair, that I think there are some of the issues, if you want to delve into them, certainly you're going to hear from CDVSA today. You're going to hear from other people. I think the victims' advocacy piece in here, both from the commission's requirements and from my own personal conviction, are being worked at the best we can do. It's better than the system we have now, Madam Chair.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Those provisions, do you remember the costs for implementing them on victims' rights?
I think there's a fiscal note on it, and no, I don't remember right off the top of my head, but I will make sure that we get to that.
We'll get to that.
Other questions from committee members? Thank you, Senator Coghill. I know you
I'll
have
excuse myself if it's okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schilling, did you have any additional comments to provide the committee? I wanted to commend you while you're... Senator was in the room that yesterday's 55-minute sectional presentation was very informative, and for those that were following in the public, gave them a better understanding of the sections of the bill. They are numerous and sometimes tedious because they are technical conforming amendments, but necessary to implement a law. And so I appreciate all your effort yesterday, as well as the committee members staying in place to hear from you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, I'd like to invite Lori Morton, the Executive Director on the Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, to the microphone. Ms. Morton, if you could place yourself on the record, your affiliation, and then we do have a presentation. I'd like to point the general public to a presentation online in Senate Finance. CDVSA and Reinvestment is how it's titled.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for the record. My name is Laurie Morton. I'm the Executive Director of the State's Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We appreciate the opportunity to come before you today and talk about reinvestment. And included in the packet you should have available to you is a report that was generated as part of the Criminal Justice Commission's Reinvestment Act with the Victim Service Roundtable. There were two roundtables held last fall. There was also someone, a national expert that worked with Pew, Ms. Ann Seymour, who interviewed several different survivors of victims of violent crime in the Anchorage area. Those comments were wrapped up into that report. You'll see that there were 10 priority recommendations from the Victim Service Roundtables. Those got rolled up into priorities in the overall criminal justice system report and led to Section 61 of the bill before you on page 101, which adds uncodified language instructing the council to create or expand community-based violence prevention programming and services for victims of a crime involving domestic violence or sexual assault. I'd just like to mention Alaska is the first state involved with the Pew Justice Reinvestment Initiative. The it listed victims' issues as one of the top priorities, which I think shows how strong the commitment is from all branches of government to support victims while addressing these crimes, and the council appreciates that support. I want to start by sharing some good news with you and advocate a comprehensive strategic approach to reinvestment dollars to further prevention efforts and strengthen services throughout the state. And first, a little context for the good news. For years, we've heard that Alaska leads the nation in the number of assaults, intimate partner violence, sexual violence, child sexual abuse that our women and children endure. Until 2010, most of the information supporting this was anecdotal or based on scattered reports to law enforcement. In 2010, the first statewide Alaska victimization survey revealed 58 out of every 100 Alaska women suffered intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or both over their lifetime. Subsequent regional surveys from 2011 to 2014 showed a consistency with those overall state numbers. We had data from women themselves that supported the antidotes and law enforcement reports. This caused us to have a focused attention on how we could prevent these crimes from ever occurring in the first place. In 2015, which brings us to the good news, we resurveyed at a statewide level and found that our focused attention paid off. The 2015 statewide victimization survey shows a decline in the number of women who have suffered intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or both, not only over their lifetime, but in the prior year in which the study was conducted.
Ms. Martin, we do have a question. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just don't want to let it pass by, and maybe I hope I didn't miss it, but what do you attribute the drop to?
We're getting to that through the chair, Representative Dunleavy. And we can't exactly say that it is all of the prevention efforts, but we know that's what changed during those 5 years. So we still had victim services. Previously, we had law enforcement responses. We had all of the systems in place. What was added during those 5 years were these focused primary prevention efforts. So we attribute some of that reduction to the work that's been done in communities on prevention efforts.
Senator Dunleavy.
This was the time, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was the time span when Governor Parnell's administration highlighted some of these issues, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes. So I think it's important to take a breath and to acknowledge good news. There were 6,556 fewer victims in 2015 than in 2010 due to intimate partner violence, and 3,072 fewer victims of sexual violence. So while the rates are trending in the right direction, they still remain unacceptably high. I don't want to belittle that at all. We were at 58 out of every 100 women. We've reduced to 50 out of every 100 women. That's still unacceptably high, and we need to do more work. So how do we do that? I think we continue to provide the focused attention to prevention necessary to continue the change community by community, promoting community readiness and being ready to support those efforts on both small and large scales. We have the programs, Green Dot, Coaching Boys into Men, Girls on the Run, Compass, Stand Up, Speak Up, Talk Now, Talk Often. We need to spread them further into the state. Madam Chair, you may remember back in 2003, the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault brought into the state the Center for Disease Control's Delta Project. And one of the things that they were able to do is sponsor community readiness programs in four of our communities working toward prevention. This is just a chart that shows you, if you look over a span of time and you look at building prevention capacity and the impacts, that in the first year you're just getting started, you may have one-time events, you're sort of at a low impact in your community. You're able to keep building on that. You have more than one program implemented. You're spanning across different groups of community members. And by the time you reach 8 years, you're able to have comprehensive prevention programming, you're sustaining those efforts in your communities, and you have a high impact. Primary prevention, which is really what we're talking about, looks at preventing the violence before it starts, rather than stopping it from reoccurring. You look at not just doing something that will affect how Senator Olson might behave. You're also looking at something that might affect how the whole Senate Finance Committee would behave. And then you're also looking at ways in which the whole legislature could be affected and change their norm of behavior. And then you're looking at how that expands out to our state as a whole. So that's just one example of what this is talking about when you look at individuals, influencers, the community, and society. Prevention activities aren't just one-time events. They're occurring across the community, and they happen all the time. Violence is very complex, and in order to address it, prevention must be reoccurring and multifaceted. Madam Chair, I understand that a fiscal note is available. Looking at the possible reinvestment dollars, I believe Ms. Robb from OMB had a cost estimate of about $5 million that was going to be split between Health and Social Services and the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault in some way. If indeed the council were to receive half of that, the $2.5 million in FY17, with an additional $500,000 in FY18 in the out years, this would be one way that we would propose looking at expending those dollars. We would provide comprehensive implementation of Green Dot throughout the state in a staged series of communities. We would strengthen efforts in communities currently implementing prevention plans. Grantees are building the foundation on which reductions in violence will occur. We have 40 communities across the state that are involved in some level of prevention activities. We would support community readiness and effort to build prevention plans in communities that want to have prevention efforts and haven't been able to start those efforts yet. We would evaluate homegrown programs such as Compass and Talk Now, Talk Often to establish the evidence of their effectiveness or lack thereof. I mean, one of the things about investing in projects that communities think are going to work is you have to be able to notice if they're working or not. So you have to be able to have a way to course correct and change or shift your focus if that's necessary. We also want to continue our research engaging reduction in intimate partner violence and sexual violence, and to be able to know about changes in social norms that support these crimes. We would ask for the addition of one program coordinator in our office to be able to help us manage these projects and provide the appropriate level of technical assistance and monitoring of the grant funds. To talk a little bit more in detail about these projects, you'll see on the left of the slide a list of communities that have existing Green Dot Alaska programs. We would see ourselves strengthening training bureaus in these communities, and as I previously mentioned, add 5 regional training centers each year. And Here is some of the activities that are being done.
Lori, can you put the microphone next to your computer?
My friends can see. Want them to be safe. And so I hang out with people who care for others. When they're nice instead of mean, I'm proud of them and I build them up. These actions that promote safety are green dots. They're small moments and small actions. My friends and I put more green dots on the map than red. And together we will make our school safe.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Morton, is it, where could I go to get a copy? So you're teaching this in the schools? This Green Dot program, is that a school district function?
Through the Chair, Senator Bishop, we primarily provide the training to implement Green Dot in communities as a whole, not specifically to schools. There is a school program for Green Dot that districts could implement if they so desired. There are, I believe the program in Homer is working with the middle schools right now, and there might be another couple in the state. There's a website, green.alaska, I think it's .com, not .org. I'll get you the correct site, and that gives you a list of the activities and the materials, and you'll be able to see what specific communities are doing. So it's not particularly school-based. It's really for communities as a whole, but there's a component of it that there can be implemented in schools.
That'd be great. I'd like to see if we can take a look at that, find that in my office. But
okay.
And we'll contact you if I can't. Thank you.
Senator Machicki, did you have a question?
I can wait, Madam Chair.
Okay. Ms. Morton, please continue.
Okay. Fundamentally, violence in our community is a collection of individual choices to do harm. A red dot is a moment in time where someone's words, choices, or actions contribute to or tolerate violence in some way. Even though it's hard to get involved, the truth is when most Alaskans choose to stay out of it, more red dots are added to our map. Green Dot assumes everybody has a positive role they can play around this issue, that most people don't want anybody to get hurt, and that the reason people are not intervening is because they don't know what to do or how to do it or when to do it. And Green Dot gives you realistic ways to get involved so that you'll take action to make certain those red dots don't go unanswered. We're committed to changing the culture in Alaska from one that supports violence to one that does not tolerate violence, where every citizen knows they're expected to do something when they have the right set of tools. Funds will also be used to support local communities in expanding readiness to implement prevention services most applicable to their own community. Programs such as Girls on the Run, which is an internationally evidence-based program brought into Alaska several years ago. You'll, in the folder that was handed out, see an update of the statewide Alaska Girls on the Run program. The Aiding Women in Abuse and Rape Emergencies applied for and was the first program awarded a statewide council status for Girls on the Run. So they administrate the program with the exception of Anchorage. Anchorage has its own council because there are so many possibilities of places where Girls on the Run could be implemented. So they have their own program. Coaching Boys into Men is an evidence-based program out of a domestic violence think tank organization called Futures Without Violence, which engages high school athletic coaches to work with their teams, whether it's basketball, soccer, hockey, whatever it might be, during the course of their practices and their general season, to take time out and have information presented about what it is to be a strong man, to be respectful in relationships, and how to conduct themselves. Compass is the newest complement to our services of prevention efforts. A group of Alaska Native men from the Ketchikan area and Saxman gathered together and talked about what it would look like to be able to provide strong mentorship to young men aged 12 to 18 in the course of their everyday outdoor activities, and came up with this program, which we're in the process of evaluating now. Primary prevention really looks at trying to work with people as young as possible to help them in being able to form their social norms and habits as they grow up. So you're creating a society or community, neighborhoods, groups of people in which it is not common to experience violence. And as they grow up in that manner, then it becomes more accepted and routine. So this, we really want to focus on the work that we're doing with young people. We would increase mini grants that go out. Lead On is a statewide conference of high school youth that is youth-led and adult-sponsored, where leaders, youth leaders across the state get together and talk about what they can do in their communities and make plans and implement specific projects and activities to change their culture in their community to not accept domestic violence or sexual assault. The mini grants are mini. It's about $2,500 per project, and allows them to put their plans into action and support that youth leadership. We would increase the When I Am an Elder commercials by two communities annually and develop subsequent Talk Now, Talk Often cards. And here is one of the When I Am an Elder commercials.
I am an elder. I want to smell fresh air and tundra grass on a sunny day.
I want to hear bright laughter and parents sing Ginkumkin.
I want to know the cycle of salmon, not the cycle of violence.
When I'm an elder, I want to hear little kids playing.
I
want to
feel dance fans in my hands and feel safe in my home.
I want to feel the absence of hate.
Lastly, before I move on to the victim services, I wanted you to see the sort of depth and breadth of stakeholders that are participating in prevention activities around our state, and the way in which over these previous 5 years, people that you might not think would necessarily come together are joining together to stop these crimes.
Could we, you pause that for a moment? Is there any way we can get volume on? Brief at ease. we're back on the record for those listening. Off-net or online, we've tried to get some speakers in place so that we could hear when I'm an elder, and then we'll go to the other video. Ms. Morton, please.
When I am an elder, I want to smell fresh air and tender grass on a sunny day. I want to hear bright laughter and parents sing ding dong ding.
I want to know the cycle of sound, not the cycle of violence.
When I am an elder, I want to hear little kids play.
I
want to
feel dance fans in my hands and feel safe in my home.
I want to feel the absence of hate.
Thank you, Ms. Morton.
Thank you.
Out in our communities where all of us responding to situations, responding, and all of our resources are going to dealing with those immediate situations. And one of the things really great about this conference is that they're focused on prevention.
It's going to come together people who are interested in truly changing the cycle of domestic violence and sexual assault and in breaking the silence surrounding these elements of our community.
One of the things I learned about the significance of adverse childhood experiences, and that the remedy basically is learning some kind of resiliency.
So I love taking back all of that passion from the communities, other communities, learning what's going on all over Alaska.
I feel like all the prevention workers are slowly coming together and, you know, working in unity throughout the whole state.
People that do prevention work are brave. They are courageous and they are committed.
I really admire the people that work in this field. It takes a tremendous amount of love and care for people to do that. And I admire that and I very much enjoy working with them.
They're dedicated, they're committed, they're passionate, they're visionaries. They have tremendous heart and passion for this work.
We are invited to imagine joy and love and compassion and dignity, and as our state campaign declares, respect.
We would see culture and tradition, you know, we would see real authentic life. A house filled with happy people who are enjoying family time and working together. You will see love.
When we are successful in ending violence, our state is going to look much different. It's going to be a place where people can feel safe, where people are connected, where people have opportunities. It will be a place where people have hope.
Thank you, Ms. Morton.
Thank you.
See if I don't upset the balance of the microphones down here. I think that we are committed to prevention. Communities across the state are committed to prevention. They're willing to do the work. The conversations are starting, and we want to be able to carry forward in that work. I think more communities will start to join. I think as you call people into new ways of being and they see there is possibility, that people are willing to join you and make that happen. In addition to prevention, I think hand-in-hand going with that has to be evaluation. We're working to weave in evaluation into each strategy from the beginning so we can assist communities in strengthening their own evaluation efforts, so that we can share outcomes so that other communities can learn from what's already been tried and tested and true. I also think we need research, even though some people are less likely to appreciate that word. I being one of them, actually, for many years, because I was like, we know there's a problem. Why do we have to study it to say there's a problem? But I think what I've learned over the years of having the research conducted is that it's not necessarily to learn there's a problem. It's to hear the stories and to learn what can make a difference and how we can make a difference and what we use that will work to make that difference. There's also a study we'll be coming out with this summer on the knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs of the citizens of Alaska around domestic violence, sexual assault, and what it's going to take to end these crimes in our state, using that as a baseline with our five-year look back on the victimization study. We hope in 2020 to be able to have a 10-year look back, and really we'll be able to make some of those connections about what did work, what was it, and how are we going to continue to make that difference. So we think evaluation is a critical part of the overall plan for reinvestment. And then it was clear from the victim service roundtables that not only was violence prevention a top priority for them, but so was ensuring that services were available in rural and remote areas of our state. So they had some specific guidance around that, including safe homes, engaging elders, working with children's services, and to expand and create partnerships in rural areas. There were also a concern about victims of sexual assault needing to fly into regional hubs in order to have forensic exams, and wanting there to be a way to find opportunities for those exams to be provided closer to the victim's home or where the violence was actually perpetrated. So those would be things we would be looking at with victim services. On the left of the slide, you see where our regional programs are currently located. Each of those regional programs is responsible for the area surrounding them. So, for example, in Bethel, Tundra Women's Coalition is responsible for the villages in the YK Delta, and it is that way around the state. About 3 years ago, the legislature appropriated to the council $250,000 for emerging programs. So you'll see the last three on the list, Craig, Petersburg, and Tetlin, are what we call those emerging programs. They're not shelters. They're not going to be shelters, but they do provide local opportunities for crisis support, advocacy, support groups, individual advocacy opportunities in those small areas. Once again, trying to get services out where people are instead of having them always have to come in to a regional center. We would want to use some of this money maybe to help further sustain those programs. So I could go on and on. I think it's a critical discussion, but I know you have many more pages to go on Senate Bill 91, so I'll end there and be happy to answer questions.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Bishop.
Ms. Morton, I just wanted to thank you. I think this was you did a very good comprehensive overview of what you provide and what you're wanting to further build on your successes, and I commend you for that.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Thank you.
Just on your
methodology on your survey, 3,027 random women in the 2015 survey. The past year numbers look better. The lifetime numbers are a little bit questionable, because in a five-year span, you wouldn't think that you could move the lifetime needle that significantly. How do you explain that difference?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, and I will give it my best effort. Next week, Dr. Rose, who is the research director of the project, is going to be in Juneau. There's going to be a presentation in the Senate on the victimization survey results. It's my understanding, yes, it is something that was unexpected. We didn't think the lifetime numbers in 5 years would show such a significant difference. One of the reasons why we think we can associate particular prevention efforts with this reduction is there were 5 years of youth aging into the adult population that were now being surveyed that previously had not been. So the survey is for women age 18 and older. So there would be opportunity for those younger women to age into the population that was being studied. But I think you are not the only one that was surprised to see the lifetime reduce. But Dr. Rose is confident that it is statistically significant and the weighting of the numbers was sound, and those are correct percentages. But Madam Chair, if I might, I would defer questions specifically about the structure of the survey or how the numbers were reached. I'm happy to take those questions, and Dr. Rose could be available to answer them.
Senator Michiki, follow up?
No, it's good news. It's just the weighting would have to be so heavy on the young adults in order to change that number so significantly, and that's the reason. I don't know. Did you switch to cell phones since 2010?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, cell phones and landlines were used in both surveys.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Michiki. Ms. Morton, do you have any comments? We will be hearing from the Office of Victims' Rights later today through invited testimony. But on SB 91 before us, you've spoken to what the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault would like to do with reinvestment dollars that could be available. So that was the presentation that we just heard, and some of the good work highlighted for what you, along with the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, have been doing, as well as many other organizations working collaboratively. And I personally would like to know more about the primary prevention projects that were in the Bethel and the Dillingham area to see if we have statistically valid changes in those communities based on the investment for primary prevention. But SB 91 is before us today, and so I'd like to focus on any additional comments that you know that are either pros in SB 91, specifically under sentencing, pretrial, and supervision. Because one of the concerns I had that I put on the record is I feel like because of my work in the field some over a decade ago now, that I may be carrying a residual effect of those experiences. And what I mean in layman's terms for those at home is it's hard for me to believe that a perpetrator is not a perpetrator and still going to continue or at least have the potential to harm other children, or that a person that's in jail for a crime against a person that was violent in nature, that we're going to trust that an ankle monitor or electronic monitoring is going to be successful. But I know that at least it's been asserted that we have statistical data that is saying what we're doing isn't working and that we should try something different. And I'm just having a hard time getting, from a personal perspective and a professional experience background, having a hard time specifically with murderers and with crimes against people.
Madam Chair, It's my understanding, and I think I have read the latest version of the bill, that many areas of concern regarding victims of domestic violence and sexual assault have been addressed. There have been carve-outs made so that those offenders are going to remain with strong sanctions against them. They're not necessarily going to participate in some of the pretrial or the early release or the parole. So the bill sponsor was very willing to work with us and spent particularly Mr. Schilling hours going over our different concerns with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. Sort of the one remaining concern we had that I just noted this morning that had been modified was the earned good time credit for sex offenders, which originally in the bill was a third off of their sentence, and that's been reduced to a fifth off, and it was after a successful completion of treatment. We had difficulty with that concept of success for a sex offender when he's in jail and not out in the public where he would be more prone to commit acts of sexual assault, being able to say that he had successfully completed treatment. So that concept has been removed from the bill. It's now that they've gone through with whatever their treatment plan says. So there are some things that I'm very glad that you have the commission being able to review the progress being made in different elements of the plan. I think that's going to be necessary because we don't want unintended consequences. I don't know if all of the concerns of the Office of Victims' Rights have been addressed, but I know that for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, the bill sponsors really worked very hard. They made several changes in Senate Judiciary to address our concerns.
Ms. Morton, so I like the change from successful to completed treatment. One of the conversations yesterday that Senator Dunleavy asked about was, is there someone that could talk to us from a scientific perspective with statistical data to talk to us about repeat crimes, recidivism of a crime once someone is out of jail. And Mr. Schilling makes a valid point that, which is why I want to talk publicly about it, that these rapists, these folks that have been convicted of a crime against another person, are coming back onto the street one way or another, that most of these folks don't have lifetime sentences, most of them have long sentences, and that our primary goal is to keep people safe. It's not to save money. Our primary goal is to make sure people are safe. But I don't want to speak for everyone, I'll speak for myself, but you always want to have hope that somebody can be returned to society and be productive in a way that benefits both a past victim and the future community that that person might enter into. So I always want to have hope. I personally don't believe in the death penalty for a variety of reasons, humanity just being one of them from my perspective. But I also have a hard time having sex offenders return into society. So a sex offender is the closest thing that gets me to reviewing a death penalty, because I have a hard time believing that a biological reaction to an attraction that is socially so far out of the norm that is damaging small children can be change during a treatment process. So that's a prefaces to ask you, is there someone that could provide this committee that you know any scientific data on a batterers prevention program or some kind of sexual violence treatment program that can show us statistically that there is an opportunity for actual rehabilitation?
Madam Chair, Not off the top of my head, but I will go back to the office and look at our materials and get some names to you. I think that there are, in my limited knowledge of sex offender treatment, there are different reasons behind sex offending. Someone who is going to molest a child has a different makeup than someone who is going to sexually assault an adult. I share some of the same concerns that you've enumerated with people who are going to sexually molest children. So I don't know, but I will get you some names.
Thank you. There was, when I was the executive director of Standing Together Against Rape STAR, there was a male psychologist or psychiatrist, I believe in Anchorage, that asserted that he had a program that would modify the behavior of a sexual perpetrator after completion of his program. But again, I was the director and my job was to advocate for victims. And as much as I wanted to hear his message, I had a hard time processing that message with the violence and the harm that I saw walking through the doors of a rape crisis center some every day of the week, and children once or twice a day, and not necessarily through our doors, but knowing that that was happening in our community. Senator Dunleavy?
Just along those lines, it's a catch-all term. I think parts of it need to be carved out, like the pedophile concept. And I'm sure there's science, up-to-date science, across the country that can actually come up with a profile of an individual that their chances of rehabilitation are slim to none, and they can be treated differently. That might be helpful. And we talked yesterday, I'm not sure if you heard it, but there may be a case where you had an individual just turned 18, an individual that's on the verge of turning 16 or 15, they have a relationship, but it's not one that's a battering relationship or one that's it's a different category that those folks might be treated differently in terms of their treatment or their incarceration. But for me, the big concern is I've seen no evidence in the science that I'm reading that there are certain classes of folks that are pedophiles that you can't really cure that issue. You can try and treat it, but for the most part, whatever that is, that demon stays with that person for quite some time. And I'm not an expert, but that's what I'd like to do, is hear from experts on how to deal with that.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. It was brought to my attention, I was asked why I described the psychiatrist or psychologist as male, and I just want to put out in the record it wasn't the male or female. I was trying to assist in identifying the person who contacted the agency, so it's not in respect to a sex. It's just, as I recall, the person that was providing the treatment was in gender male, and I thought that it would at least eliminate 50% of the population, as Ms. Morton tried to look for that person. Anything else? I know that at least as the chairman of this committee, I've spoken to my members and asked them to give this area a fair exploration of the committee's time. I do not want to take past experiences and not be receptive to new ideas that have statistically valid science, but I am very concerned, specifically as Senator Dunleavy had said, about someone who commits crimes against children. Both are situations of power, whether it's an adult or a child, but there seems to be something physical that is happening in a different way with a premeditated act of violence versus a system reaction towards violence. Ms. Morton, is there anything else? So we talked about sentencing and the carve-outs that have been changed on sexual assault and violence under pretrial, early release, and parole. Is there anything else in here that we should be aware of in your work as problematic or that needs to be addressed that isn't addressed?
No, ma'am.
Do you have a position from the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault on the conversation this committee had about the difference between a nonviolent offense of sexual assault versus a violent offense. And what I'm, what we were talking about previously was the issue of young men being placed on the sex offenders registry when they had consensual sex with an underage person. So it could go either way. It could be a woman on the list too. I don't mean to identify men as the perpetrators, but the statistics as I knew them a decade ago were 95% of the perpetrators were male. So in respect to all of my colleagues and all of the men in Alaska, I'm just talking globally and not meant to offend anyone, but that those are the statistics in our state as far as perpetration goes. So when we're looking at our sex offenders list, there are some folks that are on the sex offenders list that the person, the victim in the case in the state of Alaska versus that person that's now in jail, incarcerated or on the list, that that person actually engaged in consensual sex from that person's perspective and possibly from the victim's perspective. And should there be a carve-out or some way to review or look at the statutory rape provision on and how those young folks are staying on the system?
Madam Chair, I didn't hear the conversation and would want to know more about that so the council doesn't have a position. It is difficult for us to think about sexual violence in terms of it not being violent. So it is an invasion of the other person's body. That's one thing. I think that if you are an adult, it is your responsibility to make sure you understand the age of the person to which you may become sexually attracted or involved. That's your responsibility, to make sure that that person is also an adult and can understand the consequences of what it means to have a sexual encounter. I think regardless of what your physical characteristics are when you are 12 or 13, whether you're a young man or a young woman who may look 14 or 15 or 16 or older, it doesn't mean that you have the mental or emotional experience to be able to fully consent to that kind of behavior. So we would be concerned if there was an automatic, well, it's okay.
Ms. Morton, no one was thinking an automatic, it's okay. The conversation was around a young man that might be 19 having sex consensually with someone and not having done what they were supposed to do and check ID and thinking that someone was over the age just by where they were showing up or whatever those circumstances are, and they wind up on the sex offenders list. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you that young men need to know who they are engaging in sex with. They need to know their name would be a start. Their age is certainly required. And there should not be alcohol involved in any way, shape, or form, because you get into the issue of whether it's consensual or not if someone's drinking. But anyway, we can have that conversation further. It was brought up that there are some younger men on the list that may or may not have been sex offenders as we define them and what we're talking about here, though I totally understand and agree with the definition and the interpretation that you provided us today.
Madam Chair, I guess I would just like to add 19 is not a child.
The other question, Ms. Morton, that came up yesterday was the issue of addiction in regards to someone who perpetrates a crime of sexual violence. is a pedophiler addicted? Is someone who is sexually deviant addicted? And if there is an addiction, is there a treatment or is there a cure? If you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic, whether you're drinking or not. And so I believe the question was, if you're a sexual perpetrator, are you always a sexual perpetrator, or is there some treatment that can make you recognize that the behavior is hurting other people and that would stop you from doing that again?
Madam Chair, I'm not trying to evade your answer. I just don't know. I think that would be for the expert that we would try to get before the committee to talk about.
Thank you, Ms. Morton. And that was the committee's difficulty yesterday. And I know several members asked that question to understand the science behind that. Anything else for Ms. Morton? And for those watching at home or sitting in the room, it's an uncomfortable conversation for us as it is for you. Anything we've said here today has triggered any emotional response, that you need to contact a local support system. Standing Together Against Rape has a hotline available. You can Google that, or I don't know the number, but we can get you that number if you call my office here in Juneau. I know these are difficult things, especially when you're talking about young children. Ms. Morton, thank you for visiting with us today. Again, we are trying to do the people's business in understanding how issues of violence of all natures are affected by the bill before us.
Might I just say one more thing, Madam Chair? The Safe Children's Task Force that is looking at implementing of Aaron and Bree's law, I think as teachers and parents and children are able to get appropriate education materials and information as they progress through years of school, it will also help in being able to establish appropriate boundaries and ways in which to interact with each other in dating relationships, both regarding physical or sexual violence or activity. And I think that could be one way in which there would be less of a concern about what's brought up, maybe about the young people interacting. When we have children who have had 5, 6, 7 years of information and materials along with their teachers and parents, by the time they get into junior high and high school, I think we'll have different school cultures.
Ms. Morton, thank you for bringing that up. I serve on that task force, Alaska Child Safety Task Force, with you, and I just wanted to thank Senator Dunleavy. This entire finance committee supported me in my efforts. I had told the governor that there were some ideas from the last 10 years that we wanted to put into place in that bill as it was going forward. And in his effort to do what he believed was right for Alaska, he pushed hard last legislative session to accomplish what he thought was in the best benefits of Alaskans. And so with Senator Dunleavy's help, he took to my caucus with me a variety of issues specifically to assist young folks with these training opportunities inside of the schools, and I just wanted to publicly thank him for his work. I know there was some controversy, and I felt like Senator Dunleavy received some unfair criticism on the issue of sexual violence and child education over the last couple years, and it would not have happened without the help of him and this committee in being able to insert the different items that we did for a variety of teaching opportunities inside of the schools, whether it's suicide, domestic violence and sexual assault, alcohol, drug treatment. He worked with my office to make sure that we could support that and gain support throughout this legislative body. Thank you, Ms. Morton. The next person to speak before the committee is Carmen Gutierrez. Carmen, are you online? You are.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. I'm online. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Carmen, if you could identify yourself and any affiliation. You just identified your name, but any affiliation, and then could you provide us comments on SB 91?
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Carmen Gutierrez. I am the owner of Justice Improvement Solutions. Just by way of background, very briefly, I've spent my entire working career in the criminal justice field as a criminal defense attorney, the deputy commissioner for the Department of Corrections, and now in my current capacity working on many of the same reentry and criminal justice reform issues that I started during my time at Corrections. I'm here today, and very appreciatively, to express my strong support for SB 91. As you all know too well, the way we currently conduct criminal justice in Alaska is simply not sustainable, both in terms of financial and human cost, both to the victim and to the perpetrator. We expend a tremendous amount of money on our criminal justice system. For example, in FY16, $324 million on the Department of Corrections alone. And this doesn't even include courts, public safety, the Department of Law, and the cost of indigent criminal defense. And what do we get in return for this? Two out of three inmates return within the first 3 years. And most of those people return within the first 6 months. And that is because we release them without any sort of community-based supports. We simply cannot maintain the failed practices of the past and think we are promoting public safety for Alaskans. This past, our criminal justice system results, amply demonstrates the cold reality that prison alone is not a cost-effective public safety strategy. So the reasons I support SB 91 is because, in my opinion, based upon my experience, SB 91 promotes public safety reentry strategies aimed at not providing a hand out, but a hand up. So why should we care about successful reentry? Because simply every time a person, a former offender, successfully returns to their community, we have one less crime, less criminal justice expense, healthier families, as the majority of people convicted of crimes are parents, and communities. And most, and very importantly, we have earned the goodwill of Alaskan citizens by pursuing policies that actually promote public safety. Sadly, though, this is not what is happening today, yet hopefully SB 91, if passed, will improve the way we do criminal justice business today. SB 91 supports evidence-based recidivism reduction, public safety promotion efforts through looking at evidence-based practices that have been informed by a tremendous amount of criminal justice research that helps our criminal justice practitioners ID those individuals who are at risk of reoffending. It identifies their needs that must be addressed to decrease that risk. It then enables prison officials and probation officers to identify a comprehensive plan to address those risks and needs. The pretrial services program, if funded by the legislature, is a mechanism to encourage offenders at a truly teachable moment. In the many years I worked as a criminal defense attorney, the first thing I would do was to get my client into a treatment program and ensure they completed it. Just after arrest or charge, they're in a crisis moment where they could actually see and feel how their lives had become out of control. The ability to go into treatment when they were actually receptive to do so in many cases changed their lives and impacted in a positive way for them and for the community and for our system, the sentence they received. The federal system has been using pretrial services for decades. This keeps the offender in the community safely by monitoring them in a public safety-minded fashion. It is far more effective than the third-party custodian system we currently use, which I respectfully submit is simply a fiction that helps judges and prosecutors feel that they are promoting public safety, when in reality, that is not necessarily the case. SB 91, through Justice Reinvestment, funds community-based treatments such as substance abuse and cognitive behavioral treatment. According to the Washington State Institute of Public Policy, the single most effective way to change an offender's pattern of criminality is to require participation in a cognitive behavioral treatment program that can be offered in the community. This can be done so very inexpensively. It doesn't require a psychologist to do the work. In fact, lay people are trained and provide these services very effectively and, again, very inexpensively. In order for people to be successful upon release from prison, they need the basics. A key to successful reentry is the ability to find employment. There are far too many barriers for individuals with criminal records to successfully find living wage jobs today. The American Bar Association examined all of Alaska's statutes and regulations and found that 1,625 Alaska statutes and regs imposed collateral consequences for offenders convicted of felonies and misdemeanors. Many of these collateral consequences pertain to housing, employment, and the receipt of benefits such as food stamps and the ability to drive a vehicle. In my opinion, respectfully, SB 91 attempts to remove or to remedy one of the greatest impediments to returning citizens, the inability to drive legally a vehicle for as long as life or in many cases for 10 years after conviction, despite the fact that the individual has demonstrated his or her rehabilitation. As you can well imagine, even in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, cities with transit systems, it would be very difficult to conduct your life without a driver's license, much less live in a community without transit. So even when these people want to be law-abiding, they drive, and they do so without insurance. They do this not to intentionally violate the law, but to do so that they are able to earn a living to support their families. SB 91 balances public safety with giving reformed offenders a chance so they are able to conduct the necessities of their lives in a law-abiding way. The bill gives restoration of driving privileges not to everyone, but only to those who have demonstrated clearly to the court the fact of their rehabilitation. So lastly, I would like, if I may, to make a few comments on when it is that the state policymakers should think about when expensive prison beds should be used. And I respectfully submit that our expensive prison beds should be used for the dangerous offenders. The people we have good reason, based on risk, need assessment tools, not hunches, not gut feelings, and who demonstrate through their ongoing behavior that we know they're simply not redeemable. While working as a criminal defense attorney and during my time at the Department of Corrections, I learned that you could divide the offender population into three categories. Those who were so horrified by being involved in the criminal justice system, you knew they would never come back. Another third are individuals who, for whatever unfortunate reasons, cannot or will not change their behavior. These are the offenders who warrant the expenditure of our expensive prison beds. The last third are the people that I think we're really talking about here. These are the people who could go either way. This last third are the people on whom we need to devote our criminal justice reinvestment resources. But we simply cannot do that when they're released from custody, where probation officers don't have tools to promote their rehabilitation in the community. In order for that to occur, we need effective, well-run substance abuse treatment programs. We need effective cognitive behavioral treatment programs so that when somebody is beginning to slip and slide on probation, there is a resource available to try to keep them in the community safely in a public safety-minded way. Lastly, I would very much like to thank Senator Coghill and Senator Ellis and the other sponsors of this bill for their courageous leadership by introducing it. I also am deeply grateful to the Senate Finance Committee for the time, attention, and energy that it is giving to this important, I think, game-changing legislation. I recognize you will and have heard from many naysayers who, for whatever reasons, cannot support the necessary change advocated by this bill. When you consider the testimony of the people in support and in opposition of the bill, I think we need to keep in mind whether or not we can afford to continue on with the failed practices of the past. Thank you again for the time and the opportunity to talk about this piece of legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Gutierrez. Are there questions from committee members? Carmen, thank you for your service, not only to the state of Alaska, but all of the different organizations that you have worked with over the years that I've known you. We really appreciate your continued investment in trying to have a better Alaska.
Thank you so much, Madam Chairman. It is truly my pleasure.
The next person and final speaker invited today is Kathleen McLaughlin with Partners for Progress. Kathleen, are you available online?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kathleen McLaughlin. I'm the director of the Partners Reentry Center in Anchorage, Alaska. And the purpose of my testimony is to show support for SB 91, but also to talk about not what Senator Coghill was talking about, which is the, I think he called it the high-level view, but the boots-on-the-ground view. Partners Reentry Center is designed to take people immediately out of incarceration and also work on a pre-release plan with them when possible. And so we have been able to gain some information about how we can, through SB 91 and through justice reinvestment, enhance the ability for people to return to their communities safely and also to be able to do it in a cost-effective manner. What was interesting to me today is I think that when I was listening to other testimony, that the reality of this bill is that it unites a lot of groups that you would think would have different goals. Victims and reentrants oftentimes are the same person. And what I was realizing with prior testimony was the same individuals, many of the same individuals who are victims are also the reentrants. Just 2 days ago, it was interesting to me. We had someone walk in, needed immediate housing, and she had been the victim of a significant domestic violence episode. But she herself also had a criminal record. And we were able to house her immediately, and she got a job the next day. My point is that I think that SB 91 brings us all together in a way that we probably didn't, at least I didn't expect, but in a way that is more safety driven, and it's also more not soft on crime but smart on crime. With respect to the Reentry Center, I just wanted to share some statistics and be open for questions. We've been open since August of 2013. We have served almost 3,000 individuals. Our moneyed services are focused on people coming out with felony records or misdemeanors with a treatment component. We have a real-time database. So any statistics that you would like, I'm happy to provide to you. The statistics that I can give you right now is of our 2,992 individuals that have passed through our doors. On average, we see between 60 and 84 people a day. We have about 100 to 105 new applications a month. We do immediate service and referral, meaning that we aren't having people waitlist. We don't have a waitlist at our place. Instead, we take people as they are when they walk in the door. If they are felons or misdemeanors with a ASAP or a treatment requirement, we will house them the very day that they release. Because what we have found is within the first 30 days, because we are serving people that would otherwise be homeless, the first 30 days are sometimes the most risky because they have the highest LSIR scores or the highest risk needs assessments. They would otherwise be homeless. And this is the population that has the highest chance of recidivating. On average, we are housing between 80 and 85 people at any given time, but we're not entitling them to housing. It's not a free ride. They have to partner with us so that not only do they have to work in our program, and we found out statistically, if they participate in our program 2 to 3 times a week, that they're less likely to recidivate because they're gaining a purpose and a positive experience when they re-enter, rather than the other option, which would be that they are released at the Anchorage Jail parking lot and they're asked to do the best they can and report to their PO within 24 hours. If you're homeless, that is a very dangerous time. So our goal is to get people immediately upon release. We get about 20 to 22 people a week who release to us. One of the beauties of Senate Bill 91, I think, is that this is a statewide bill. We have a lot of people going to Anchorage who come to Anchorage by default, either because they need treatment or their probation and parole conditions require that, or they don't have the reentry services in their various communities. And I think SB 91 recognizes that reentry and reducing recidivism and providing safe areas for people to live and safe communities is a goal that can be reached, and this is one step in that direction. As a result of what we've seen, just some additional statistics, 34% of our population is Alaska Natives, a little bit over 1,000. 500 of them are sex offenders, have sex offenses or sexual assault convictions. And Madam Chair, when you were talking about a perpetrator is always a perpetrator, what we have found is, yes, there are certain individuals who are, lack of a better term, hardwired to make decisions that are dangerous to society. In our experience with the individuals that we work with that have sex offense charges, the individuals that have that high risk and should be, the community should be protected of, is very, 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 very small. The sexual offense and sexual assault, and I'm not minimizing them at all, a lot of them, they need to be accountable, and they need to be responsible for their behavior, and the communities also need to heal, and a restorative justice model, which I think is implanted in SB 91, is a great way for us as a society to allow communities to heal and for individuals to be able to be held accountable and to keep our community safe. With regard to our program, one of the things that we have done is we have been nimble enough to be able to look at what works and what doesn't work. And one of the keys, I think, to any reentry plan is it has to be evidence-based, it has to be data-driven, and we have to be honest about what we do and what we don't do. When we don't know what to do, we refer out. We have immediate referrals. We've been able to, as a result of that, partner with other people in the reentry field, and also to see the weaknesses within the reentry programs that exist. A couple programs that I think I just wanted to point out that have some legs under them right now that we've developed as a way of looking at the reality of reentry and then addressing that. One is our Vivitrol program. Vivitrol is a medically assisted treatment for individuals that are coming out who had heroin, opiate, or alcohol addictions. We have partnered with the manufacturer of that drug, along with my health clinic. So we are giving people Vivitrol shots the day they release. And here are the statistics with regard to that. We started in September, and this was all a product of seeing heroin overdoses within the first 30 days of release. People were using at the same level that they had been using prior to incarceration, and one very significant event in my life was when we had a reentrant who was 24 years old, who got a job, was safely housed, partied one night to celebrate his employment, and was dead the next morning. And he was not somebody that you would think. He wasn't on the street. He was from a stable family in Anchorage. And what touched me was that addiction is classless. It doesn't affect a certain level of individuals. It affects us as a society. So we, as partners, made a commitment, and we have been using Vivitrol on our wellness court, but we made a commitment to try it on reentry. So this is the deal that we set up. Starting in September, if people have strong opiate, heroin, or alcohol abuse issues, our housing, for some, was contingent on them using Vivitrol. For others, we made it an opportunity for them to change their lives. And as of yesterday, and this is the very beginning of this program, we had 49 people who we are tracking with respect to this. Of those 49, 28 have chosen to do Vivitrol. Four just took it this week, so I can't put them into this statistic. So of those 28, 24 of them who accepted, starting in September and forward, only four have recidivated. And all four who recidivated, intentionally or because of medical advice that was not accurate, did not take the second shot, because this is a continuation of shots for 6 months to a year. And they recidivated after they didn't take the second shot. Of the 21 who declined and said, we're going to do it on our own, 19 were reincarcerated within the first 30 days. One is still out, and one is, there's a warrant out for that person's arrest for failure to report. That causes me to believe we're on to something. Because this could be a costly program, we do it for basically nothing. We do it with the partnership of my health clinic, who does the injections. We sign people up for Medicaid the day that they re-enter, and we are now working on having people sign up for Medicaid before they release, so that their Medicaid, if they are Medicaid eligible, would be available. But the first shot, there's no cost to that, and the second shot would then be covered by Medicaid. So this is a no-cost event for purposes of our grant and for the money that we have received from the legislature and through our DBH grant at this point. My point is, what we have learned at Partners Reentry Center is, how do we be nimble enough so that we can respond to the needs of the community, to keep it safe, and also to give a reentrant an opportunity to succeed if they are able to. The second thing that we have been working on with the in concert with the Department of Corrections, and I have to say, one of the shifts that I've seen in the Department of Corrections is that with reentry, we have a reentry, statewide reentry coordinator with the Department of Corrections, who we work closely with. And this is a partnership that probably would not have been in existence 10 years ago. But it's because people are motivated to see what the right thing for society is. And the reality is 90 to 95% of the people that are incarcerated are going to be released. So it's not if they're going to release, it's when they're going to release. But with the Department of Corrections, one of the things that we've been looking at is, of the Alaska Natives that have come through our program, half of them don't even want to be in Anchorage. And as a result of that, we have looked at how do we get them home in a safe way. So we have now a Native reentry group, which is meeting right now at the center. It's 25 to 30 Native Alaskans who are making amends to their community. They're asking if they can be invited back to their villages under safe circumstances. And we are working with the Department of Corrections to get them home. Because one of the things that we, our system has failed, is for a lot of Alaska Natives who are not urban skilled, they can't get jobs very easily in Anchorage, and they find themselves involuntarily displaced. And as a result, that's when you have the highest likelihood of getting into trouble. So our goal is working with the Department of Corrections to get people home if, A, they're invited back into their communities, B, there's a safety plan, and C, that there is some form of oversight to ensure that there is not going to be a risk to the community. I just wanted to do an overview real quick and be available for questions. I would invite all of you to come to the Partners Reentry Center. We're open. We're a walk-in. And one of the things that I think is very key to all these programs is transparency and data-driven services. Because if we aren't transparent about what we do, and if we aren't looking at our data and saying, are we making a difference, we shouldn't be doing what we're doing. And with that, I'll be open for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. The bells are ringing and calling us to the floor of the Senate. Is there questions for Ms. McLaughlin? Seeing that, I wanted to ask you very briefly. You made a statement that you're going to now have or work with prisoners that are getting ready to be released to apply for assistance programs prior to their departure from jail. I don't believe that is allowable currently under state law, and at least my office has been contacted for a technical amendment to allow that to happen. Is that your understanding, or do you think that you can do it under existing state law?
Well, what we are doing that, If people are 30 days or less from release from either a halfway house or from any of the institutions, we are able to have them prepare Medicaid applications. For those that are in the halfway house, they actually come to the center, and they're still in the halfway house. They come to the center, and we have the United Way and the Alaska Food Coalition SNAP representative who is signing them up. Now, they don't become effective until the date of release. So you don't get Medicaid benefits or any other benefits prior to release, but we put them in the queue so that there isn't a waste of time upon their release to get benefits that they're entitled to.
Thank you. Other questions from committee members? Seeing none, Ms. McLaughlin, thank you for joining us and sharing the positive work that your reentry program is working on. That was, again, Partners for Progress. I would like to quickly go to the DMV who's been online. They're only here for questions, but I would just ask Nicole Thame, we have some driver's license provisions that are in SB 91. Do you have comments versus questions that you'd like to provide the committee? Nicole is gone. Jason Whiteside, are you there?
Hi, yes. Madam Chair, this is Jason Whiteside, JaysonWhiteside, with the Division of Motor Vehicles, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Mr. Whiteside, does the Division have any comments, either positive, negative, or neutral, on the changes that are proposed in SB 91 on the driver's license provision to allow folks back to obtain a driver's license?
The section that allows drivers to reobtain the driving privileges when their court case has been dismissed or acquitted. The DMV is certainly in support of that. There has always been a small percentage of folks who have ended up with an administrative license revocation for one reason or another, and their court case ends up getting dismissed for whatever reason. And there really hasn't been a clause in the law to address that population, and I do find that SB 91 does create that clause and gives some relief to drivers who fall into that category.
Thank you for those comments. Any further comments for the DMV? We have, I don't see public safety online right now. I'd like to let the committee know that we're going to start public testimony at 1 p.m. today. We will take invited testimony first from Ann Seymour. She's calling us from the East Coast. She's a national crime victim advocate, and Mr. Schilling referenced her yesterday as someone who had been a huge victim rights advocate for jail time, and how through science and evidence-based data she's come to a different conclusion on how we might support folks who have wound up in our prisons, as well as Catherine Hansen. She's the staff attorney for the Office of Victims' Rights. Is there anyone here in Juneau wishing to testify on SB 91? Anyone at all? With that, we'll open the public hearing again at 1 o'clock this afternoon. We're adjourned. Excuse me, Senator Dunleavy.
Sorry, Madam Chair, just very quickly. Maybe Mr. Schilling can find other states to look at in terms of if they've carved out or have segregated the umbrella concept of sexual assaults, how they've dealt with it, and how they handle that.
Mr. Schilling, if you could approach the microphone. Mr. Schilling, did you hear Senator Dunleavy's question?
Yeah, for the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. So just so I know exactly what I should be looking for, how other states treat sex offenders in regards to discretionary parole.
Sure. The different types of sexual assaults, do they treat those that would be a pedophile, how do they treat them with prison time, treatment, and other groups under that umbrella? How are they treated differently, if at all? Maybe they're not.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I would imagine that states do accommodate for the different spectrums of sex offenses, but I'd be happy to look into that for you.
Just one last question. You had a number of states listed a couple days ago, like Kentucky and others, that have shown a large drop in recidivism. Maybe they're the states that we look at to see if they do something differently.
Sure. Mr. Schilling, can you get that? I understood your request, Senator Dunleavy, of the exceptions that Alaska is suggested that we carve out as this process has been going forward on smart justice. Have other states carved out specific offenses like sexual assault and then perpetrators crimes against children differently or any concept? So we appreciate that.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Senator Machicki.
Just for the record, I recommend folks reading Section 1141.434 when we talk about the sexual abuse of a minor from the first through fourth degrees. I was kind of looking for why they go with the logic that there's no reason to prove intent or consent because a minor under a certain age, just the way the law sees it, simply doesn't have the ability to provide consent. They just don't. It's an interesting read on some of the cases that have occurred and how the courts have viewed those cases. So just suggested reading if you have a few minutes, or it's 6 or 7 pages.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. I missed it before. Mr. Gary Folger, are you there? Department of Public Safety?
Madam Chair, Commissioner of Public Safety, Gary Folger. I'm just here to answer questions as needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I just wanted to make sure, are you neutral? Are you in favor? Or do you have any amendments or specific comments that you want to make on SB 91?
Madam Chair, again, Gary Folger, we are in support of this bill. we were in the process all along the way, and the concerns we had were addressed. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. With that, is there anything else to come before the committee? We're adjourned.